That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show. We are live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. And like we said, this is That Money Show, one of the only places on radio where you get an entire hour to do one thing and one thing only, and that is to make you better with your money. I feel like that's a pretty good promise. Don't know about you, didn't get much education in school myself, so let's go and do it on the radio instead. Sounds like a good deal. Anyway, what we got coming up this week? We've got quite the show ahead of us. Of course, we always break down what's going on in the news, the bigger stories, the things that I can download, digest, and make really simple for you to understand so you can go ahead and sound smart to all of your mates at your next dinner party. And then, of course, we always bring in the biggest guests, range of expert, famous faces, and just generally interesting people to share their own personal finance advice and stories and experiences to, again, make you better with money. Hopefully they share some interesting mistakes they might have made, so you don't have to make them yourself. And this week we've got Bobby Seagull, the maths teacher, author of the book The Life-Changing Magic of Numbers, broadcaster and personal finance columnist at the iPaper and Financial Times. And we also have Daniel Knott, a mortgage and insurance advisor at Active Mortgages. So quite the show ahead of you. I would stick around for the entire thing, but as promised, we always like to kick off with the news. Not just any news, the relevant news, the stuff that will affect the money in your pocket so that you can actually go ahead and be prepared and not surprised when things start to change. And you're like, hey, I actually knew that was coming because I listened to That Money Show. And what is coming ahead of us? Well, there's a lot of talk and it's going to ramp up even more and more about the changes to the tax system coming in April. Now, of course, this is all off the back of the Chancellor Rachel Reeves budget that she announced in October of last year, 2024. A lot of these changes only actually happen at the end of the tax year or the financial year, which is April 5th/6th, coming up in 3 to 4 months. Again, my math isn't great off the top of my head. And the change in particular that I wanted to discuss with you today is, will it be harder for people to enter the workforce, especially for people entering at the lower salary range, especially, again, if you're coming in on national minimum wage? Well, that is the opinion of the boss of the retail giant Next, who is quoted to say, specifically, the tax changes announced in the budget could make it harder for people to enter the workforce. This is Lord Wolfson, who told the BBC that a rise in national insurance paid by businesses would hit the retail sector in particular, and meant that the axe had fallen particularly hard on entry-level jobs. So for those of you listening who potentially are coming to the end of a degree or getting to the end of school and are thinking of applying and joining the workforce, does this mean that you're going to have a much harder time trying to find yourself a job after this April? So what's going on? Should we rewind a little bit and going back to the beginning and explain why it's going to be harder to enter the workforce? Essentially, things are going to get more expensive for businesses. And the two things that Lord Wolfson, the boss of the retail giant Next, is referring to is, number one, the rise in national insurance. Now, normally, when you hear national insurance, you might think about the tax that you have to pay on top of your income tax that you have to pay. National insurance is the other big one. Some people think that national insurance is like specifically towards like pensions and the NHS. It's not true. It just kind of all goes into one big pot that the government get to spend from. But anyway, the national insurance that I'm actually referring to is the one that is paid by the business, by the employer. And this went up, or is going up this April, from 13.8% up to 15%. So they're going to have to pay 15% of anything you earn. And it used to be above £9,100, but that is now going up to, well, down to anything above £5,000 a year. So you can already see that this cost of hiring someone is going to get more. Now, let me tell you exactly how much more that is going to be after I tell you of the other change that is going to quite incredibly impact employers, and that is the rise in national minimum wage. Now, this is actually something that most employers should expect. It does tend to go up year after year after year, and this year it went up from £11.44 an hour to £12.21 an hour. Quite a large change. If maths is working correctly in my head, it's somewhere between 6 and 7%. So quite a sizable raise. And this is the impact that's going to have on the average business. So let's say this year you are on national minimum wage and you're working your 37 and a half hours a week at £11.40 for an hour, which is the current national minimum wage. Your employer has to pay £1,822.70 in national insurance. Quite a lot, a large amount, £1,800. But what is going to happen as of this April? Well, your national minimum wage, or just generally the national minimum wage, is going up to £12.21 per hour. Now, again, let's say we take a normal job, 37 and a half hours a week, which is 7.5 hours a day, so 9 to 5:30, you get your lunch break in the middle. But now with the increase in national insurance up to 15% and the rate at which they have to start paying going down to 5%, £5,000, national insurance is now going to be at £2,821.35. That is an increase of pretty much to the penny £1,000 for every full-time person who is earning national minimum wage, or a percentage increase of 55% on every single employee. Now, you can start to understand why businesses that hire a lot of people on national minimum wage are thinking to themselves, I've got to not just pay another salary, but pay another £1,000 more or less on national insurance. And that is before the increase on the actual wage on top of that, which is probably also another £1,000 that they have to pay as well. And of course, for one or two or three employees, this might not make such a big impact. But for large businesses that are hiring thousands of employees every single year, this is a significant amount. And Lord Wolfson might be right in saying that there are going to be fewer hires next year when businesses start to look at, you know, how many people they're going to hire. So this is definitely something you want to be aware of. If you're going into very entry-level jobs, you want to make sure that, you know, you are really putting yourself forward in a good light, because it's not just going to be guaranteed work anymore. They're really going to scrutinize every single job that they give out. Now, the government's kind of response to this is that most companies shouldn't struggle trying to hire more people because of a slight increase in national insurance and an expected increase in the national minimum wage. But companies are becoming frugal this year. They are really going to start analysing everything. In fact, it also is kind of coming into the, analytical side of things, is that the top, the highest rate payers as well are also going to start to be axed. You'll kind of see the top and the bottom. The people in the middle might kind of not see much change in particular in terms of the amount of jobs that are available, but those who are coming in at the lowest wages and those who are currently on the top wages might start to see a really big struggle off the back of this. Now, of course, we will keep you up to speed with what are the actual changes that are going to happen as we approach the month of April, and to see if this is actually coming into practice. But if one of the largest employers in the entire country Next is starting to say this, then I would assume a lot of others, especially in the retail industry where national minimum wage is really, really common, might start to share that kind of same response. I've said this before and I'll keep saying it many times. It is actually expected that over the long term, the majority of these costs that the businesses are going to face because of the changes that the government have implemented are going to actually fall on the consumer. But what isn't said is they're also going to fall on the worker. Less jobs, more money saved. And that is how companies are going to pass on the costs of these raises in tax onto the average person. At the end of the day, all taxes end really on the worker. Most businesses like to keep their profit and will try and keep as much of it as possible. Now, we've also got a really interesting story about mortgages. In a newly published letter, the UK's financial regulator, the FCA, says it will investigate ways to simplify rules brought in following the 2008 financial crisis. And this is in response to the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, the Chancellor, and the Business Secretary writing to the UK's main regulators in December, asking them to come up with ways and ideas to reform the current system to boost economic growth. And one of the ways that they're currently talking about are the strict rules on mortgage lending, which could be loosened to allow more people to borrow for a home. So essentially, the idea is if more people can start to buy a home, borrow more money, stimulate the economy. And it's, remember, this government is all about growth, growth, growth. They might be failing miserably at it at the moment, but they're still thinking about growth, growth, growth. And so one way, of course, is to make more people borrow, allow people to borrow more money towards properties, which is one of the hardest things and also one of the largest things that anyone will ever have to borrow for. And that is obviously a clear way to boost the economy. Now, the big red flags that hopefully are going off in most people's head is, I don't know if you remember something that happened about 16 years ago where, you know, it was very easy to borrow money for properties and it ended up causing a massive financial crisis. And of course, that is probably the thing that the FCA have at the back of their mind constantly when hearing this idea to loosen regulations and rules about borrowing money, because that is exactly what happened in 2008 and it caused one of the biggest shit shows to ever hit financial markets internationally and almost ruined several economies and put several banks under. So you can obviously imagine that that means that a lot of governments and especially regulators are going to be very wary about loosening this idea. Now, another idea they've put out is the idea of increasing the amount that contactless payments can currently have in shops. Now, Apple Pay, Samsung Pay, Google Pay, whatever they're called, have different limits because they are set by the provider themselves. But contactless cards are currently still limited at £100. Now, when they came in, I'd love to say I know off the top of my head exactly when they came in, but when they did come in several years ago, they were actually limited at £10. A contactless payment was £10. And the idea behind it was that you could use a contactless if you needed to just, you know, pick up the odd bits and bobs. If you forgot something down the supermarket, you had to run out really quickly and you just wanted to do something really, really speedily, you know, a quick tap, £5. So you forgot your pint of milk. I'm not saying a pint of milk costs £5, but you get what I'm saying. You can go down, do your contactless tap and run away. Now, of course, that's now up to £100. I don't know if people are spending £100 on milk. If you are, or how many people are in your house. But the idea now is, could they get rid of this limit altogether or increase it yet once again? Now, what's the logic behind this? If you're able to spend more through contactless, it kind of incentivizes more people to spend a little bit more money because it's a little bit more easy to spend more money. And yet again, growth through spending and stimulation within the economy. Now, of course, again, if you're thinking red flags right now, the one that you should be thinking of is more spending, more aggressive spending, inflation, right? We're trying to keep inflation under wraps right now. We've had a very tough few years recently, and we're trying to keep it within that number two starting at the beginning of it. We have done that over the past few months. It went up a little bit to the high end of the twos. We've gone back to the mid twos at the moment, and we're trying to keep it under wraps. But yeah, listen, we're going to have a good chat about all these various ideas, and especially that one about mortgages with a guest coming on soon called Daniel Knott, the Mortgage and Insurance Advisor, Active Mortgages. So stick around for that conversation to understand what loosening these mortgage regulations might actually mean to the market. Now, when I was reading this, I did have a few thoughts to myself of what other things could the government do to try and kind of improve the financial economy that we live within. And I've got a few brilliant ones. Okay, number one, tax calculators. Self-employed people have to figure out how much tax they owe every single year when they submit their self-assessment. HMRC don't tell them. You have to get it right. If you get it wrong, that's illegal. But HMRC know how much you owe, but will not tell you how much you owe. You have to do it yourself or pay for an accountant to do it for you. I'm not saying it's hard, but I just love for the government to build a system where they could just tell you and you wouldn't get it wrong every single time. Thanks. Secondly, what about digital IDs? I was just thinking about this the other day where I carry my driving license with me absolutely bloody everywhere it's not like I'm going out for a drink that often, but you know, you never know. You might get ID'd. I'm not saying I look under 25, but I wouldn't mind the compliment here or there. I'm only 27, just saying. But why are these not digital yet? And when is that going to come? I think they've been talking about it for ages, but like, let's get a move on. Anyway, that is everything that you need to know about the news right now. So stick around, because straight after this, I'm going to be joined by Bobby Segal, the maths teacher, author of the book, The Life-Changing Magic of Numbers, broadcaster and personal finance columnist at the iPaper and Financial Times.
FUPAR Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SAS sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either, because obviously they can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, "What the fuck are those?" And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen. listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.
What would you be advising the Labour leadership to do at this point?
My view is just apologise. I went to the theatre last night. I'm with my wife and family, and as I'm walking, a bloke says very loudly, John McDonnell, has he paid for his tickets? I went back to the bloke, said, yeah, I did pay for my tickets, and I always do. What that whole ticketing thing and all the free gifts thing doesn't just damage those individuals, it damages us all, because they all think, oh, they're all the same, and we're not.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the truth. And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. But I'm not alone anymore. I am now going to be joined on the show by the one, the only, Bobby Segal, the maths teacher, author of the book The Life-Changing Magic of Numbers, broadcaster and personal finance columnist at the iPaper and Financial Times. That's quite the intro, Bobby. Welcome back to That Money Show. How are you doing?
It's a pleasure to see you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. I'll let you get away with that. What am I looking at? The 20th of January. Happy New Year.
We haven't spoken in person this year, so I say in January, my sort of rule is if I've not met them in person or spoken to them, I can get away with it till the end of Jan.
I'll let you get away with it. I probably would have said it if you hadn't said it first, so that's fine anyway. Bobby, I think today we're going to be talking about hobbies, if that's okay with you. And people might be thinking, what on earth have hobbies got to do on a money show? But it's all to do with an article that you actually wrote last June, where you decided to tally up the cost of all of your hobbies throughout your own experiences that year, etc., etc. Why did you do this, and what did you learn from it?
So I think when people think about their income and expenses, you think, okay, I get, you know, your main job, maybe a couple of, you know, freelancy side hustles, and my expenses are, you know, your mortgage, your rent, holidays, maybe your car. But actually, our hobbies cost money as well, whether it's, again, I thought about my gym habits, my book reading habits, my dating, going to football games. And all these things are like, yeah, they make life fun, but they're not usually free. They cost something. So I thought actually it's quite a good exercise for me to see how much of my life I'm spending on inverted commas fun things.
Okay, so I've got the article in front of me, and if it's okay with you, I'm assuming it is, seeing as you wrote this publicly in an article. Let's go through some of the costs that you went through and you found out. So we've got £425 a year fitness and running. Do we think that's gone up or down since then?
Oh gosh, you know what, I'm ashamed to say it's gone up, because I've joined another leisure centre. So I'm this year, one of my ambitions is to learn to swim properly. So I joined a swimming centre, which obviously is an additional fee, because my current gym doesn't have a swim centre. So actually, that's probably gone up by another 300.
And that's probably not so surprising, because I suppose, let's say, the average, you know, 24-hour gym, the cheaper ones are around £30 a month, let's kind of estimate. That's something like £350 a year. So 425. I mean, if people are looking at this thinking surprise, you might want to go and check your own bills when it comes to all your fitness stuff. And that doesn't include buying, you know, your gym clothes, buying all of your trainers if you're a runner.
And now you mentioned trainers.
Oh, there we go. The fresh pair that have turned up today.
So, to be honest, I've always been a bit miserly in terms of spending material things on myself, but I'm doing a half marathon, the Brighton half marathon in March, so I properly got into my running. So I bought a fancy pair of those, you know, carbon plated, or be on sale, 130 down from 165. It's a carbon plated fancy trainer, so I look like one of those people at a park run on a Saturday, like, oh my god, why are they spending this money on trainers? But it's for, I feel better because I bought it in a sale.
Bobby, you're talking my language. You're going to have to talk after the show because I've decided to sign up to the London Marathon in April and I'm currently training for that. And I bought my trainers for the marathon before I had a spot. So it was a sale. Again, I waited till it was a very good discount and I was ready to return them if I didn't get my spot. Just got to put that out there. Some people who do discuss personal finance on the internet can make bad financial decisions as well. It's absolutely acceptable. We've got dancing, £840 a year. Now, this is quite a unique one.
Yeah, so one of my friends, we actually did a TV show together called The Real Dirty Dancing. And we were, he was all right. I was diabolical. I was, to be honest, I was quite comedy value for the show. Mm-hmm. But my dancing was a disaster, let's be honest. So he invited me, said, Bobby, come to West London. I live in East. And I signed up for dance classes. So I went for quite a while. And it's 70, 80 quid a month. And eventually, to be honest, I gave up, not because of the cost, but because of the time it took to travel. It took like an hour there, an hour back. And people who are not from London think, hour's not very long. But in London, if you're travelling an hour to get somewhere, that's quite a distance.
You're basically crossing the entire city.
So that habit, the dance habit is temporarily paused, but I am looking at dance studios around East London. So that 800 is like I've not spent it. It's still there in my sort of metaphorical pot waiting to be released to find another dance club.
Got it. And again, you got to remember travel costs to get to your hobby. They do count as well. And it is important, as well as the time cost. What could you have done in the time that it took you to get from east to west? And then a few of the others, book clubs, £180 a year, dating, £575 a year, lucky girls, or guys, whoever you are. West Ham support, £500 a year, and Richard the... you're going to have to explain this one to me. It says here, Richard the Third fascination, £32 a year. I don't think I can tell you a single thing about Richard the Third. What is this fascination with him, and why does it cost £32 a year?
Okay. So I was in Leicester for an event, and on the way back from the from my hotel to the station, I walked past a church and I said, this is where Richard III is buried. And he's quite famous for having been quite maligned by Shakespeare. There's a play of Richard III with the withered hand, and apparently he murdered two princes in the tower. You know, I'm there to say he didn't. There's no evidence. but I spent like 2-3 hours. I missed my train. I got absorbed in the history of this guy. I've even seen a play about Richard III, the Shakespeare one, and I've been obsessed reading books, listening to podcasts, and joining the society. And now I'm probably going to attend these weekly or annual conferences, which will cost me money, but it's a weekend, so it's like a really niche hobby. But I think that's our hobbies. Like, initially you get this little spark, Gabriel, and then it takes you down this rabbit hole, and you look at your bank account, it does cost money.
Yeah, and this is the important part of the chat. I mean, everything that I've just mentioned just there probably racked up to about £2,500 on all of those different hobbies. We're not talking small sums here in the slightest. And I also don't think that, okay, maybe dancing was a little bit more because not a lot of people have an expensive dance hobby. But the other ones were quite normal, I would say. I don't think they were out of the blue in terms of the gym costs or going to watch football, if that's something that you like to do. I think no one can have a go at you for a £30 Richard III fascination. That's absolutely, absolutely fine. But I think the reason why I'm discussing and sharing all of these things, and I assume the reason why you shared this in the article a few months ago, was about, is it time to spend a little more time focusing on the cost of all of these fun activities in your life? I mean, what did you learn from taking a deep dive into your finances here?
So I think it was in terms of course, we spend money on hobbies, and it's a useful spend if you enjoy it and you actually take part. As I know, we're in the new year now, so many people will sign up for, you know, gyms or clubs or societies, or, you know, get a season ticket but not attend. And that's the problem. If you spend money and it's just coming out of your direct debits every month, you know, 30-40 quid, and you think, oh, it's not that much, but after 6 months, a year, maybe 2 years, it does stack up to serious wads of cash. So I think it's you know, we are human, and I'm not that kind of person that says, you know, cut out on your coffee. If the coffee brings you joy, spend the money, but make sure you do enjoy it. Make sure you do use your gym membership. Or again, simple sort of hacks, like I'm a book, avid book reader, so I'm part of a book club and we pay fees to attend these monthly big sessions, but I make sure my books, I go and I get them from the library. Here's it. This is my, this is the most precious thing in my wallet, my library card. I use it so much for audiobooks, for physical books. So again, I read, but I found a hack. It's not like a hack, but, you know, use your library card. But there's always ways of having a hobby. Running could be joining a running club, and it can be quite cheap because once you pay the initial outlay, each session is not that much. Mm. So I think it's like trying to find those little ways of making your hobbies less expensive.
I think this is brilliant, and I want to dive more into this idea of how to make hobbies cheaper, because I'm also an advocate of you should spend money to have fun throughout your life, especially at any age. Obviously, your people are always focused on the saving side of money, but it is just as vital to have that balance and to save and spend some on things that you truly and really, really enjoy. But if there are ways to save money as well whilst doing it, and don't put down the library card hack, I think that you'll find that more people have ignored that than are actually taking advantage of it. So technically, I think that does make it a hack. But it's really important to cut the costs down. For example, again, like you said, if you buy a season ticket and that's something that you love and you're not attending a game, that is a lot of money if you do not sell that ticket and you are not actively looking out to sell that ticket, because they can stack up. You miss three or four games, you could a couple of hundred quid potentially, especially if you're following a Premier League club, especially if you're following a club like Arsenal, like me, that have some of the most expensive season tickets in the entire world. But these are really important things. And the other side of that, that I was briefly mentioning with you, is the, I describe them as like phantom costs around hobbies that are just as important. I mentioned to you the idea of running shoes and the outfit, but the idea of travel cost, for those of you that are listening, I'm getting a great display of these beautiful Nike trainers that look very well worn. Let me say that, very well worn. They're getting good use. They have definitely some distance in those. And the idea of making sure you're aware of the costs that come with the activity that you have chosen. For example, the travel costs to and from, the food that you buy maybe when you're attending a football game, when you're going dancing, you're traveling from East to West London. That's not cheap to travel that far for that long. When you're going to the gym, you know, the cost of getting there, the cost of the equipment that you buy and all that kind of stuff, maybe the odd PT lesson that you add onto it here or there. So these are really important. How can we track them effectively? I don't even know how I would go back and actually tally up all of these costs. So do you have any effective practical tips that you can share to track and budget these fun activities in our life?
Yeah, so I've got like the old school millennial way and then the new sort of the cooler way. The old school is I quite like using spreadsheets, Excel. I've got a tracker, not everything, but just like my hobbies, because I know that it does cost money. And also it's a way for me to, it incentivizes me to actually participate in that hobby. Because if I'm a member of a gym, I'm like, I've got to use the gym X number of times, like at least 10, 12 times a month. So I think that's the old school way. So for our older or more experienced listeners, but for the younger ones, like for example, on my some of my banking apps, the bright orange card one, the Monzo one in particular, there are other banking apps available. They're really good at allocating your spending. So whenever you have a spend, like a direct debit, or you spend on the day, and imagine you go to the gym and you buy like a protein shake after the class, you can allocate it immediately towards categories. So then it becomes a part of your whole year spending, because albeit, you know, I know our year's spending, you know, we've got our major parts like our rent, mortgage, our travel, but our hobbies still filter into that. For example, the travel costs. So I like to get a sense of actually, I might spend £2,000 on travel, but actually another £500 came from my hobbies. So I think it's using the apps and apps. And there's so many, again, it's one thing about when I grew up, it was much more about pen and paper, you write your things down. But now I think using apps, that's, you know, that's the great way of making sure that we're on track.
Yeah, and a lot of people are probably thinking, oh, tell me which app, which exact one. But the truth is there are so many. Just go for one, download it, use the free version of it. You don't need to be paying for apps these days in any way, shape or form. Link your bank cards. It's super easy to do it this day. That's all very secure and safe to link bank accounts, open banking, as long as it's all FSCS protected. A lot of these banks are just reading the data, or a lot of these budgeting apps are just reading the data. They can't actually do anything with your money, which is very important to say. And make sure you are accurately tracking it. So if you just see travel and you're like, oh, that's just going to travel expenses, should that actually be looped in, that specific one day travel, to your entertainment or to your activity or to your hobby category? Really something to definitely kind of clean up a little bit in January, the beginning of the year. This is the time of year where you can reorganize those buckets. And if you're not doing it, get on it because it's really important. So I think lastly, just before we do let you leave, on the topic of hobbies, you mentioned the library card, which I think is a brilliant idea, a great way to save because, you know, books cost, let's say £10 on average for a book. If you're reading, you know, 20 books a year, again, significant money, podcasting, getting the audio apps and all that kind of stuff. So what are some clever ways that you've used to save money on your hobbies so that you can still enjoy them to the max, but save on the, I was going to say on the tax just because it rhymed, but that doesn't make sense. Save on the money.
I think, again, I when I think about the gym, I know there are people that go to like these great classes like Barry's Bootcamp or F45, these classes, but sometimes find a gym that does classes within the membership. So I've got a gym that does like spin classes, HIIT classes, Pilates. So my £40 outlay a month covers those things. So see if you can, again, it's probably not as good as the premium experience of going to like a Barry's or F45, but that's meant that I get my classes, but I'm saving costs there. Also think about if you're going to these events, often again, clubs, activities are quite social. Find a buddy so you can save on like travel in the car together. Or if you're getting a meal together afterwards, someone's got like an NHS discount because they're a doctor or a nurse. So I think it's working together with other people. And you can make them your accountability buddies, because if you're part of a book club or a running club or a dance club, these people, or a football club, these people, your friends, will make sure that you're making the most of it. Because, you know, if you do things by yourself, sometimes you can, you know, if you've got strong willpower, but often we're like, oh, I can't be bothered. Mm. You know, willpower, I think, is a easily targeted power. But if you use other people, whether it's a WhatsApp group, those people will keep you on track. So never underestimate the value of people in keeping you honest to your spending.
Oh, brilliant. I'm going to add one more thing that you mentioned, but you didn't stress enough, which is, if you're not using it anymore, like the dance classes, cancel them. Please cancel them straight away.
Cut.
Because those are the secret subscription costs that drain your money without you noticing. Bobby, thank you so much for coming on That Money Show once again. And Happy New Year. I'm looking forward to the article about your hobbies this June.
Yes, a new one will be coming out.
Thank you very much. Well, there you go. That was Bobby Seagull on all of his hobbies, how expensive they are, and how you can stay on top of their finances. Anyway, it's time for my money tip of the week. And I'm actually going to answer a very specific question that I've been getting quite a lot, especially at this time of year when people are looking to, you know, reshape up their money, reshape up their finances. And it is the famous topic of investing. People love to overcomplicate it. And simply, Money Tip of the Week are the four steps that you need to know to actually start investing right now. Okay, are we ready? Let's do it. Step number one, pick a platform. Any platform. I do not care. I don't care if it's Hargreaves Lansdown, Trading 212, AJ Bell, Nutmeg. There are so many out there. Pick a platform, and eventually, maybe in a year down the line, you'll find the perfect platform for you. But let's just get you started, okay? Number two, you need to open the account. You're going to be offered two types, a general investing account and a stocks and shares ISA. The difference, they do the exact same thing. The stocks and shares ISA, you don't pay tax on your gains, and that's part of your entire annual ISA allowance. Step number three, you normally need to, you know, get the account opened itself. So you picked your account. It normally requires a form of ID, verification, national insurance number, bank account to link to it, etc., etc. The typical things you'd expect when opening an account. And number four, buy an investment. Obviously, I can't give financial advice. I can't tell you what to invest into. But you actually need to buy things. You can't just put money into the account. That's like, you know, giving money to someone to buy something, but they don't actually end up buying it for you. You don't get the product at the end of the day. It's just sat there in someone else's hands. So you need to buy things like individual companies. You might have heard of, you know, Apple, Tesla, Microsoft. These are all very famous companies, or things called ETFs, which are funds that contain, you know, a number of companies with a click of one button. One of the most famous ETFs in the entire world is the S&P 500. It tracks the S&P 500, which is the 500 largest companies in the USA. They've been performing very well recently, but past performance does not indicate future returns, and all the other disclaimers, capital at risk, you've got to be aware your money can go down and up, all those kind of things. But that is literally all it takes to start investing this year. If you can't follow those four steps, what can you do? I'm sorry, guys. Maybe investing just isn't for you. But you can do it. I've got you. You can do this, guys. That is your money tip of the week. And stick around, because after this short break, I'm going to be joined by Daniel Knott, the mortgage and insurance advisor at Active Mortgages.
FUPAR Radio.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my Yes I Yes sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our boxes. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way from this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald.
What would you be advising the Labour leadership to do at this point?
My view is just apologise. I went to the theatre last night. I'm with my wife and family, and as I'm walking, a bloke says very loudly, John McDonnell, has he paid for his tickets? I went back to the bloke, said, yeah, I did pay for my tickets, and I always do. What that whole ticketing thing and all the free gifts thing doesn't just damage those individuals, it damages us all, because they all think, oh, they're all the same, and we're not.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the crazy truth. And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle. I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show live on FUBAR Radio with me, Gabriel, That Money Guy. And joining me now in the studio is Daniel Knott, the mortgage and insurance advisor at Active Mortgages. You might have seen him on socials. You might not. You probably should have straight away after this interview. But anyway, Daniel, welcome to That Money Show. How are you doing?
Thank you for having me. I'm very well. Pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you for coming all the way down, you said, from the Northeast just to come on this show, specifically just this one. I may or may not be lying, but you can figure that one out for yourselves. But of course, mortgage and insurance advisor, very hot topic at the moment. I mean, I literally spoke about an article about half an hour ago about the idea of potentially making mortgages and lending a little bit more accessible and loosening the regulation around it. But let's go back to the beginning.
Yeah.
A mortgage advisor, obviously we'll get onto the insurance in a minute. What does a mortgage advisor do?
So a mortgage advisor, the main purpose of a mortgage advisor is to help you to achieve the best possible mortgage solution on time and first time. Typically, in the modern day, it's somebody who's going to hold your hand through the full home buying process, liaising with solicitors, estate agents, helping with insurance, and yeah, being in your corner on your team to make sure you achieve that goal.
It's absolutely brilliant because it's a very complicated thing to do on your own. People can go about and do it on their own, but a lot of obviously mortgage advisors either offer their services for free or for very minimal cost when you're actually looking at it compared to the relative cost of buying a property. And they, like you said, will have the inside knowledge of what's actually going on in the market. They'll have the different providers and actually be able to get you the specific best rate for the amount that you can borrow and the percentage of the interest rates that you can borrow on the market, which obviously gives you an advantage of utilizing someone with that industry knowledge. Mm-hmm. So mortgages have been all over the place recently. About 5 years ago, they seem to be incredible. You were getting rates of, you know, 1%. Some people got sub 1%. But, you know, 1% to 2% was very normal before the pandemic in 2020. Not so much at the moment. So what's going on and why do the rates change so much in such a short period of time?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of factors that impact why interest rates may change in the current market. Unfortunately, we're not where we were in 2020 no. or 2021. We're probably not going to go back there anytime soon. Most of my home buyers at the moment will be accessing rates anywhere between 4% to maybe just over 5%, depending on circumstances, goals and the figures involved. But yeah, the interest rate that an individual can access, there's a lot of, you know, it's very complex and their individual circumstances will help them to identify that.
Mm. So it's quite scary times. People often now look at the housing market as like, oh, it seems so affordable back then at these rates. And now it's so unaffordable because, you know, the actual monthly repayments people have to pay have gone up because interest rates have gone up. So then they go down slightly, then they go up again, they go down slightly. But at the moment, like you mentioned, we're hovering around this kind of 4 to 6% bracket, maybe away from 6. Please stay away from 6. And this kind of does slightly change according to the Bank of England's interest rate, which they announce every 6 weeks, but not always, because recently we've seen the interest rate going down, but mortgages and mortgage rates have kind of gone slightly up. Why this difference?
So it's important to note that tracker rate mortgages, they are directly impacted by the Bank of England base rate. Tracker rate mortgages track the Bank of England base rate.
Simple.
Your fixed rates do not. The lender essentially sets their fixed rates at their own discretion. They want to make money, but they want to be competitive. It's more impacted by swap rates. So that is the reason why you may see fixed rates not tracking the Bank of England base rate exactly.
There you go. So it's not specifically linked, those fixed 2 to 5 years. You might have heard, you know, 5-year mortgages, 2-year mortgages. These are the ones that Dan is specifically referring to at this point in particular. Now, what I do want to ask you is about people that, you know, are looking to get onto the housing market and they're looking at current mortgage rates and they're thinking to themselves, maybe I should wait, you know, interest rates might drop in the near future again, which may mean mortgages will start to drop again. Mm-hmm. And they've been waiting. They might have been waiting for 2 or 3 years now with that kind of same frame of mind. So is there any advice or recommendation you have to someone that is trying to get onto the housing market but is put off by the current interest rates?
Absolutely. So if it's the right time for you to buy in your life, so maybe you're coming to the end of a rental agreement, you're in a relationship, you want to move out of your mum and dad's house, then it's a good time to buy. Reason being, we simply can't predict where the market's going to be in the next 1, 2, 5, 10 years. It may not be the perfect time to buy, but it's probably not going to be. So what you should do is find out via a mortgage advisor, ideally, what you can achieve in the current market. And if you can achieve your goal, i.e. buy the sort of property that you want to buy on an affordable basis, then it's a good time to buy.
Simple as that. I like that. And I always say that to people. There's no crystal ball. You don't know what's going to happen with the mortgage rates. And it simply is down to your affordability, right? If you can afford to make the purchase, now might be the right time. And I think there are two things in particular that I want to bring up with you here. Number one is, of course, when mortgage rates go down, hopefully in the near future, and you'll think to yourself, oh, I'm going to get a much better rate. That's the perfect time. Mm-hmm. Something else happens, which is house prices might start to go up because, you know, cheaper to buy houses. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the actual price, well, demand goes up. Therefore, prices go up. And all of a sudden, are you actually saving money at all now? Because, you know, the price, you might be saving on your monthly costs, but you're paying more because of the amount of the property itself. Is this a factor that people should really be aware of about the actual level of competitiveness at this point in time?
Absolutely. So historically, house prices are increasing ahead of wages, and that has always been the case over a longer period. So yeah, when you are looking to buy, we don't know where those house prices are going to be in, again, 2, 3, 5 years' time. It's not only can you generate the loan amount to cover that, the mortgage that you're going to need for the higher purchase price, but also will you have that deposit, especially with changes to stamp duty, for example, coming up in the near future. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot to consider.
Yeah, we definitely need to bring in stamp duty at this point of the conversation, because if you are literally someone listening that is on the verge of buying a house, or maybe you found the right property, but again, you're waiting for the mortgage rates and all that kind of things. Mm-hmm. Big changes to stamp duty coming in April that probably will push most people to make that purchase pre-April rather than post. So what is happening and how bad is it for that first-time buyer in particular?
Okay, so in 2022, stamp duty thresholds were increased to try and minimise the amount of stamp duty people were paying, and therefore stimulating the market. That increase in the threshold was always due to end on the 31st of March 2025, and that is unfortunately coming to an end. So first-time buyers are entitled to something called stamp duty relief, which means that first-time buyers right now at the time of this conversation don't pay stamp duty on the first £425,000 of a purchase price. However, after the 31st of March 2025, that will come down to £300,000. So to give you an example, if you are buying a property of, let's say, £425,000, if you were to complete your purchase before the 31st of March 2025, you would not pay stamp duty. If you were to complete the purchase after that date, you would pay £6,250 in stamp duty, which is quite a significant amount.
Yeah, that is a serious amount of cash and probably should make people think quite hard if they're on the verge. Maybe not to push people into the property market at this point, because we're getting quite close, and to turn something around that quickly for the biggest purchase you'll ever make in your life is difficult. But if you are on the verge, it should definitely incentivize people to speed things up. I mean, am I right in saying, and I think I was trying to do the maths earlier, that if you are on the other side of that threshold, which was the 625,000, which is the top rate of the reduced stamp duty for first-time buyers, which is now going back to 500,000, if that property is 625, you might be looking at an increase in stamp duty of over £11,000.
It's huge. It's huge for a lot of people. If somebody does have an ongoing purchase at the moment, what I would say is you need to be speaking with your solicitor, understand what is the likelihood of this purchase completing before the deadline, and also, if it's not going to complete for then, exactly how much will you be paying? Because it could be a lot of money and that could be eating into your deposit.
Okay, so I spoke right at the beginning when you came in about this article that the government are trying to push about, you know, reducing these strict rules around mortgages, how much they lend and how many people they lend to. Of course, you're starting to get feelings of 2008 when this was literally what caused the financial crash. I mean, what would this change actually mean to the average house buyer?
OK, so we can use an example of where lending is a little bit more lenient. There's a major mortgage lender which will actually lend to first-time buyers, taking a five-year fix of up to six times income. Now, depending on whether or not it's suitable, which is down to the individual, that could be a great opportunity. But there are a few myths regarding this. Well, first of all, to access that, as a sole applicant, you'll need a salary of £35,000 currently. As a joint applicant, a joint income of £55,000. This is for employed applicants only. Now, if you do meet that basic criteria, you cannot automatically borrow six times your income. There will be affordability checks. That is the absolute maximum. Six times your income will only be available to those with absolutely no debt, no children, etc. But yeah, you know, opportunities like that do seem to be starting to open up.
So there'll kind of be these more niche options maybe starting to become available. But yet again, it doesn't look like the strict criteria are going to be going anytime soon. They're going to be for the very, very kind of best criteria applicant, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And the vast majority of lenders in the UK are still capping the borrowing at around about 4.5 times income. That's the standard in the market, as it has been for a long time. And most lenders are still set on that.
Okay. So I want to ask you one final question. And I know I said earlier that no one's got a crystal ball. No one knows what's going to happen with the current mortgage rates. But using, you know, your knowledge of the market, you are a mortgage advisor after all, trained, qualified professional. Any idea what's going to happen this year with interest rates and mortgage rates? Any predictions?
Yes. So a lot of people do believe that the Bank of England base rate may come down a couple more times in 2025. However, fixed rate mortgages, which is what most home buyers will end up taking, and most of my home buyers end up taking, fixed rate mortgages, I do believe, will be pretty stable as we move throughout the year. So I'm not expecting any big changes that would impact your decision making when buying a home.
Again, this isn't financial advice. This is just Dan's guess, best guess. Who knows? There might be a catastrophic COVID change that reduces inflation massively and brings the interest rate by the Bank of England back down to 1%, and we've got mortgage rates of 2020 all over again. Probably not. Go with Dan's expectation over mine, but it could happen. Anyway, Dan, where can people find you online? And if they are looking for a mortgage advisor, where can they go and look for one?
Absolutely. So my main page is on Instagram. That is at @DanDoesMortgages_. On there, you will find examples of, you know, the clients that I'm working with, the home buyers that I'm helping, daily tips, tricks, things to help you get on the market. And although sometimes it does seem like there's a lot of doom and gloom, as you can see via my page, home buyers are buying homes. It is happening. So yeah, it can be done.
Yeah, it's not all doom and gloom. And Dan did say that with a smile on his face. I can confirm for those of you that are listening only over audio. Dan, thank you so much for coming down. And I hope people do check you out, especially if they are on the verge of first time buying and all that kind of stuff. And good luck out there. It's a crazy market. That's all I would say to people. And thanks once again for coming down to London.
Thank you for having me.
Wicked. Well, there you go. That was Dan Does Mortgages, or at Dan Does Mortgages _. I would highly, highly always recommend people going at least talking to a mortgage advisor when you are interested in moving on to your first time property or any property, anytime you're looking to remortgage. These are the professionals. You don't have to end up going with them, but it's worth a conversation. And I mean, as you clearly heard there, Dan is one of the friendliest mortgage advisors potentially in the entire world. So his social media might be a great place to start. Now, it's time for us to answer your finance questions. Every single week, you guys DM us at That Money Show on Instagram. That is our handle, with your financial questions. And we like to pick a handful to answer at the end of every show. And if you are listening live as well, you get the chance to ask questions live right here, right now. So shall we start off with Tabitha's question, who says, I want to start a small business, but I am unsure about the admin behind it, things like registering with Companies House, etc. What is the best advice you would give someone starting their own business? Okay, there are so many brilliant guides online. And to be fair, this is one of the few places that the government do make it relatively simple to start a business. You just go online, Companies House, register your business, go through all of the details. I think you have to pay £12, I want to say. It might be more than that, might be less. Don't hold me to that. Don't know why my voice is probably really high, but you're just gonna have to accept that can sometimes happen on this show. And that's the kind of best way to go about it. Now, registering your business is one thing. The upkeep of a business is another thing, in terms of making sure that your company's accounts are done by the end of the tax year, that you file your self-assessment for where you pay yourself from the business, all that kind of stuff. And for that, I would always say speak to a professional accountant. You can do all of this stuff yourself, but accountants, of course, are there to save you time, hassle, and stop you from making mistakes. Like I said, I wish we lived in a world where HMRC would just tell you how much you owe and you just paid it on the spot and they did all the calculations for you because they know exactly how much you owe, but they don't. So accountants might be your best bet. If you can do it yourself, well done. You're doing better than I am when it comes to your business. Sam, what question do you have today? Well, you have asked, I should probably put on a voice, Sam has asked, please can you help explain the different types of ISAs and the way in which an ISA works? I love this, Sam. Okay, an ISA is one of the best tax-advantaged accounts that every single person in the UK has to know about. Okay, rant over. Back to an ISA. So an ISA is an individual saving account, and what it means is that any money stored in there, once it's in there, is not subject to tax on the gains that you make, okay? So let's say that, let's compare it to a normal savings account. Right now, if you are a basic rate taxpayer, you can earn up to £1,000 in interest on your saving accounts before you have to start paying tax. A high rate taxpayer, £500. An additional rate taxpayer, nothing. You do not get any amount of interest before you have to start paying tax on the interest you earn. If you were earning that money inside of a cash ISA, which is the equivalent to a savings account, but in an ISA format, same thing, but you do not pay tax if you earn £10 million of interest in a year. Sounds pretty good. That's great. Now, the only conditions with all ISAs is you have a £20,000 per tax year allowance. That's April to April, or April 5th to April, April 6th to April 5th of the following year, across all of the different ISA accounts. So that's whether you have a cash ISA, and I'll go through the other types specifically in a minute, but a lifetime ISA, a stocks and shares ISA. Across all of those accounts, a £20,000 per tax year allowance. But due to a recent rule, you can now have as many of the same types of ISAs. And what I mean by that is you can have 5 different cash ISAs in the same year that you can open up. You used to only be able to have 1 of each type per tax year. So let's say you opened a cash ISA with, let's make up a bank, HSBC. You could therefore no longer open another cash ISA until the following tax year. There are some little things I was going to mention there, but I don't want to overcomplicate it. So what are the other types of ISAs that you need to be aware of? If you are under the age of 18, a junior ISA is going to be the one for you. A junior ISA under the age of 18 allows you to have access to either the cash ISA format or the stocks and shares ISA, but they've got junior at the back front of them because they are for under 18. A lifetime ISA. Now, this is also then going to be converted into a lifetime cash ISA or a stocks and shares ISA. The difference again between those, cash ISA, it's like a saving product. Stocks and shares ISA, as you can guess, is an investing product. but a lifetime ISA is either towards retirement, but more commonly towards buying a first-time property. Now, the great thing here is you get a £4,000. I know I'm going through a lot of numbers, so feel free to rewind this as and when you need it. But for a lifetime ISA, you get £4,000 per tax year to put into this type of account, and the government will immediately put in 25% on top of that. So that's right, if you put in the full £4,000 in the tax year, the government give you an extra £1,000 on the house. On the house? That's a funny saying, because it's towards your first-time property. You do have to be between the age of 18 and 39 for this product, and the money does have to go towards a first-time property. Otherwise, you do face a penalty if you withdraw that money for other reasons. Now, you've heard me saying the words cash ISA and stocks and shares ISA quite often, because outside of the junior and lifetime version of these products, they have their own individual versions. Cash ISA, again, just a normal savings product. A stocks and shares ISA is for investing. So if you have ever thought about opening an investing account, you might, rather than picking a normal general investing account, you opt to do this through a stocks and shares ISA format. Capiche? Capiche. Good. If you have any specific questions, because I know I just threw a lot of information at you, please do ask. Anyway, that is all we've got time for the show today. I would like to thank Bobby and Dan for spending or taking time out of their day to join us on the show. You can find us on all, well, podcasting platforms, wherever you want to listen to. Download the FUBAR Radio app if you would like to listen to us live. And you can find us at That Money Show on Instagram, where you can ask any money questions, and we will try and answer as many as we can next week. Anyway, that's all we've got time for. I've been That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show, and you are now officially better with your money.
FUBAR Radio.